2019 was a year of confusion in the United States and the Asia Pacific. After the failed Hanoi summit, the world waited for North Korea to come back to the table, which they did not do. The United States and South Korea agreed to a temporary cost-sharing arrangement for U.S. troops stationed in Korea, and Korea watchers waited for a more long-term agreement to be settled before the end of the year. This did not happen. Meanwhile, people in the United States waited for Congress to make a decision on whether they would impeach the president or not. Then, 2020 started with a bang. The United States nearly went to war with Iran, the impeachment trial of President Trump wrapped up very quickly, and the Wuhan coronavirus suddenly became the top global threat. Amidst all these rapidly changing developments, what is KAI keeping its eyes on? Our top-shelf staff are here to give you their list. With no further delay, from the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Yang Kwon, and you're listening to Korean Context. Here to discuss are the top-shelf experts from the Korea Economic Institute, Kyle Ferrier, Sang Kim, and Troy Stangaron. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So let's start with the main story coming out of 2019. Pyongyang announced in December that it no longer feels bound by its prior pledges not to conduct nuclear weapons or ballistic missile tests. And yet there were no provocations over Christmas holiday as many had expected. Troy, what do you make of all this? Could we expect a return to fire and fury, or maybe the silence from North Korea now means that we're on a more steady path?
This is the question a lot of people have, because at this point, will North Korea take and test an ICBM or another nuclear weapon? I think that there's a lot of reasons for them not to move forward on such a provocative type test, but there are concerns that they could do this. When you look at the situation right now, over the last year, North Korea has done a fairly good job of sort of calibrating the steps it took. With the coronavirus, as you mentioned, now they've shut down their own border. They're not importing. For the foreseeable future, you know, there might be additional risks to taking and doing anything. But even once that passed, a ICBM test would likely provoke a reaction. China and Russia would most likely have to take steps. That would make their economic situation more difficult. Now, that doesn't mean they might not try to take and do a test in a way that they could get out of this. You know, people talked about the idea of a satellite launch, something where they could claim, and maybe the Russians, the Chinese could say, well, it's not really a test. But at the end of the day, I think much of what we saw last year is more likely to continue, to where you have calibrated tests so they can improve their capabilities, but not something that reaches the threshold to where there might be a negative international reaction towards them.
Right, like engine tests, things that are components of ballistic missile tests or nuclear experiments. That sounds really fine and well for perhaps North Korea not explicitly provoking some kind of a hot war. But do you anticipate maybe another effort at actually coming to the table and negotiating a peace agreement?
I think the United States would like to start negotiations back up. It's difficult to know how far you could get at this point. You have the U.S. election in November. The North Koreans most likely would want something that could be solidified. So you'd have to have a deal soon so that could be passed. They wouldn't want, if Trump lost, you know, an agreement being overturned, and that would be a risk. So there's factors mitigating against perhaps a big deal, but perhaps, you know, we can get an initial small deal to start the process going. I think the United States would like to at least get talks moving forward, but I think the challenge has been, you know, there have been only a handful of meetings between the U.S. and North Korea, and we should be, you know, clear here. It's the North Koreans who have refused to meet. And so until they're willing to meet, and until they're willing to say what types of security guarantees they need, what types of things are they really willing to negotiate on, I think it's hard to see a path forward on the negotiation side as well.
Right. And of course, we must not forget that the security situation on the Korean Peninsula is best defended by a strong alliance between South Korea and the United States. Now, there are some hiccups in this, however. There are currently contentious negotiations between Seoul and Washington on how to split the cost for hosting U.S. troops in South Korea. The new special measures agreement, unsurprisingly, lapsed their December 31st deadline. But Kyle, this is something that happened last year as well. We had the SMA agreements, the negotiations went on for a little longer, but at the end of the day, Washington and Seoul were still able to negotiate a short-term agreement. Is this year any different?
Well, we'll find out, won't we? I think we had a meeting in January between the two sides, not really sure what transpired. didn't seem as if both sides were able to bridge the gap all that much, and that we're having meetings coming up in February, but what's key to look out for, April 1st is when the U.S. government would start to have to furlough South Korean employees working for U.S. forces in Korea, which is something that didn't happen last time, because by this time last year, we already had a deal between the United States and South Korea, and now we don't have one. What's really important to look at moving forward as well is how the election turns out with Trump. And we can talk about that a little bit later. But it'll be really interesting to see what sort of agreement both sides are able to reach. Should an agreement be reached in the next coming months or weeks, hopefully, weeks or days? Because as you mentioned earlier, last year we had a short-term deal, one-year agreement. Previous iterations were multi-year deals. And ideally, the South Korean side would like to not pay as much as the U.S. government is demanding its $5 billion price tag, but also they would like to have a longer period so they don't have to keep revisiting the same issue.
Right, right. Now, it is one thing to have a one-off blip in the negotiations where South Korea and the United States can't come to an agreement, so they have a one-time short-term deal. When this becomes a pattern, when you have it for the second year or a third year, does this have a degrading effect on the alliance?
So I was in Seoul in September last year talking with South Korean experts on the SMA and what impact it would have on the alliance. And I talked with about 10 to 15 people, and pretty much the unanimous agreement was that South Korea could put up for this for maybe a couple of years. But if Trump were to win re-election and this were to be the standard policy, it's not something that the South Korean government would really be able to put up with in the alliance. So it is really important that we find a way in which we can amicably resolve this issue and not just kick the can down the road like we did last year.
Now, one of the reasons why the United States feels comfortable in demanding a 400% increase in South Korea's contributions to the hosting of U.S. troops in South Korea is partly because South Korea is such a rapidly growing economy in the world. It is one of the powerhouses of East Asia. However, recently, the South Korean economy has been in the doldrums. Even if the country hits a 2.4% growth target this year, it would mark the first time since at least 1954 that the country recorded back-to-back years of lower than 2.5% growth. Now, at this stage, Kyle, what are the prospects for economic growth in South Korea in 2020?
They look not as great as the government thinks they should look. So as you mentioned, it's a 2.4% growth target. Many economists think right now the South Korean economy only grew about 1.9%, which is much lower than it had originally anticipated earlier that year, which was about 2.6%. And now there's some challenges within the South Korean economy. Moon Jae-in's income-led growth policies haven't been as fruitful as him and his supporters would necessarily would like. And then there's also major external factors which look to be switching around for the positive for South Korea. I'm talking specifically about semiconductor prices, which were set to rebound, as well as the phase one trade deal between the United States and China. But the coronavirus is a new variable which really could dampen South Korea growth prospects this year. A couple of South Korean think tanks have looked at this already and estimate that if it continues to spread in South Korea, the coronavirus could cause South Korean GDP growth to fall by as much as 0.2 percentage points, essentially based off of last year's growth, about a 10% loss in growth. When an economy that's already slow and struggling as much as South Korea is in recent years, it's really not a great development for them. It's not a welcome time when things look like they were back on the mend. So the coronavirus really could throw a wrench in Moon Jae-in's plan to fix the economy.
You mentioned income-led growth and whether it be reversed. People have been critical of the Moon administration for pursuing, but there have been a series of studies that have been done. Most recently, one by the British government, a sort of meta-study of minimum wage increases around the world. And what they've found is that contrary to what economists traditionally believe, there actually is a negative effect. Now, they caveat this that there might be, once you start reaching certain levels of median income, potentially a barrier to how far you can go. But right now, we're probably not at that point. So I think the challenge in South Korea hasn't necessarily been the increases in minimum wage, but just the rapid nature of them. Like if you look, for example, the British, both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party have been supportive of minimum wage increases. They're fairly frequent, but they're also fairly small. In South Korea, we saw very large jumps very quickly. And so I think going forward, when we look at this idea, perhaps there needs to be a broader understanding, preferably cross-party, that there is perhaps a certain level of median income we want to keep the minimum wage at, and that there'll be a series of small increases rather than these sort of large ones we've seen in the last couple of years.
Right. I mean, these are all very difficult questions to tackle, in part because South Korea is, of course, also catching up to years of very slow minimum wage growth. So these are all very important public policy challenges. Now, Kyle mentioned earlier some external challenges facing South Korea. One of the largest external risks that the South Korean economy faced last year was the relations with Japan. The two countries' relationship hit one of their lowest points since the two countries normalized relations in 1965, in part stemming from legacy issues from Japan's occupation of Korea between 1910 and 1945. Troy, you recently wrote about the fallout from the two countries' diplomatic spat, how that has affected the economy. Could you speak on this a little bit?
So if we look at the trade data, there are a few things that stand out. One, overall, relations economically between Korea and Japan, there were already declines in both exports and imports with Japan before this broke out. There's not a significant shift overall that stands out. So in terms of the overall relationship, this doesn't seem to have had a specific impact. Now, when we break that down into more specific areas, you can start to see some impact. So for example, there are the three chemicals that Japan placed national security restrictions on. One of them, hydrogen fluoride, largely is no longer imported from Japan by South Korea. Now, some of that could be Japanese restrictions. Some of that could be South Korean companies having found replacements, probably a combination of both. At the same time, some of the other two chemicals, for example, photoresists, Japan has given a three-year license to Korea. There doesn't seem to be much of an impact on imports from Japan. So on that aspect, on the semiconductor industry, it doesn't seem to have really impacted things. Now, there's also been the boycott on the South Korean side. And here as well, you could say, and by boycott, I should be clear, we're talking about a public boycott, not a boycott by the South Korean government. But
not a Chinese-style boycott.
Yeah, exactly. This was something that had genuine grassroots support rather than government-led support, if you will. So Japan, you know, and I went back, I can't remember if it was 10 or 20 years, but was the top import destination for beer into South Korea. Now, essentially, beer is not imported into South Korea anymore from Japan. One other area that people have talked about, though, is, for example, boycotts of Japanese automobiles. There's probably been some impact, but if you look at the first half data, a lot of the companies already had declines in sales of about 25%. Honda, interestingly, had a large increase, and they finished the year with an increase, but there was a decline from the first half of the year. And for like Toyota, for example, it was about a 10% difference. So some, but you could also maybe argue there might have been other factors at play because it's not significant. It's more unclear or more murky on the automobile side. We've seen in some areas some specific impact, like beer, to where it's very clear. Autos, perhaps there's some impact. And then you have others to where, on like the garment side, Uniqlo, the Japanese fast fashion retailer, has had problems, but it's not clear that it's necessarily impacted the textile trade between Japan and South Korea. It's a more nuanced answer than perhaps it's been either good or bad.
Right, right. I mean, like, what I'm getting is that in 2019, despite the political furor, we don't actually see very clearly if whether or not this has had a direct trade impact. But could it get worse, Troy?
One of the things that we don't know if it'll happen is whether the assets that have been seized by the South Korean Supreme Court for the workers who have sued over the labor rights issue during the Second World War will get liquidated. If they are, the expectation is that the Japanese government most likely would retaliate. And so that could return us to what looked like early in the fall, a spiral of negative relations to where each side did tit-for-tat responses to each other. That being said, we have the National Assembly elections coming up. It seems unlikely the courts would try to inject themselves domestically by liquidating assets right beforehand. At least one would hope they would not do something like that. So probably wouldn't see anything, I would think, until at least after April if the courts move forward. You also have the Olympics in Japan, which might also be another point that might help preclude things as well. But you know, at the end of the day, at some point, you would think that the courts will likely move forward. Both governments are trying to talk through this. And at the end of the day, I think that's probably going to be where they're going to need to try and expedite things, because if they can come up with a solution, we can avoid the potential for escalation.
Now, one of the reasons why the trade spat with Japan was such a huge external risk that people were looking at was because South Korean economy is so dependent on semiconductor exports, and Japan is one of the producers of the input parts for South Korea's semiconductor industry. Now, in recent years, in addition to the dispute with Japan, the U.S.-China trade war has also had an impact on South Korea's semiconductor industry. At this critical moment, a lot of people in the industry are hanging their hats on the promise of 5G infrastructure, boosting international demand for semiconductor chips. Could you explain, Troy, how commercialization of 5G might impact and benefit South Korea?
There's two ways this would benefit. One, Samsung is sort of at the forefront of producing 5G phones. So there is an obvious new market for that. And so as 5G is deployed, and these will be higher revenue phones, so they'll have a higher profit margin, that'll help boost Samsung there, and South Korea would benefit. But more specifically, and where it's more interesting, is on the 5G network side. South Korea hadn't really been much of a player on the network equipment side. This in the past had been Ericsson, Nokia, some U.S. companies like Cisco. But when it comes to 5G, the U.S. companies haven't really invested in the technology. And so what you've seen now is you've seen the rise of Huawei, which is seen as a security risk by the United States, and Nokia and Ericsson really at the forefront. But Samsung actually spent a lot to invest in trying to develop 5G equipment. And in recent quarters, for example, on some of the components, Samsung is actually now the leading seller. And so has all of these 5G network areas are developed in different countries and rolled out, there's increasing prospects for Samsung to become a bigger player in this. And, you know, just to give another example, the United Kingdom recently came out with its policy. And rather than do an outright ban of Huawei like the United States asked, they decided that Huawei wouldn't be able to take and provide equipment for certain sensitive security core areas. And that also in other parts of the country, it would be capped at 35%. And one of the hopes that the British government has is that Samsung might actually be able to enter the market and become a major player. They also want Nokia and Ericsson to, but they'd like to diversify so that way they're not dependent on any one maker. And so there are real commercial opportunities in the deployment of 5G networks for Samsung specifically, but South Korea more broadly.
Now, it sounds like a lot of this is going to depend on the course direction of the U.S.-China trade war, which in turn is going to be dependent upon who wins the White House in November of 2020. A lot of other issues are contingent on the outcome of the U.S. presidential elections. We talked about the special measures agreement earlier. Kyle, how might the November election in the United States affect burden sharing between South Korea and the United States?
So if Trump were to win re-election, we would have a similar policy that South Korea has been subject to on the special measures agreement that has been going on for the past couple of years, so that we could probably expect to see something like that continue throughout the presidency of Donald Trump. And so if that were to happen, the alliance would really take a big hit. And again, as I mentioned earlier, I was in Korea in September talking with experts there, and there was major concern about this happening, and everyone's concerned about what it would mean for the alliance, but no one was really able to convey a clear sense of what exactly could happen. And there's a lot of different possible scenarios, but what seems to be the most advocated in South Korea right now is for South Korea to possibly get its own nuclear deterrent against the North, which would possibly include nuclear subs, things along those lines, which really would upend longstanding norms in the relationship and really could have negative spillover effects in the region in terms of rearmament in Japan, as well as the potential spread of nuclear weapons in the region as well. So there's potentially a lot at stake depending on what happens in the election coming up in November and if U.S. policy continues down the path that we're currently going down.
And of course, in addition to the security issues, there's a lot riding on the trade front as well. Troy, how might the 2020 election affect trade dynamics in the Asia Pacific?
So I think this is one of those things to where, similar to the Trump administration coming into office, if Trump were to lose, you could see a major shift. Let's start, though, with if Trump remains in office. If we see a second Trump administration, I think you're likely to see many of the tariffs on China become the new normal. And you're likely to see the continued efforts to push countries to have more favorable terms with the United States on trade, be it either in Southeast Asia as their trade surpluses rise, or in the case of South Korea, if the deficit were to continue to grow, you might see renewed pressure on South Korea to find a way to reduce that trade deficit. It's less clear, because we don't have a Democratic nominee yet, what the trade policy would look like, but my guess is it would be less confrontational. It would probably shift to different issues. If someone like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren would end up being the nominee and the president, you'd probably see more focus on pushing countries to do better jobs enforcing labor rights. You might also see the EU is pushing the idea of a basically border adjustment tax for carbon emissions. You might actually see some consensus or meeting of the minds between the United States and Europe on something like that. If you had a more moderate candidate, I think in terms of things like China, the tariffs would probably stay in place for a while, but over time, we'd probably move towards a more normal relationship. But I think even a moderate candidate would probably place some more emphasis on issues like environment and labor rights. It just wouldn't be necessarily quite as strong of an emphasis as maybe we might see from a Warren or a Sanders presidency.
Now, of course, the United States is not the only country having elections in 2020. South Korea is also going to be engaged in a election in April. It's going to be for all 300 seats in the country's unicameral legislature. Sang, why does this election matter for Korea?
This election is critical for President Moon and also for his party. Similar to the midterm election in the United States, this April election will be a litmus test for South Korean public's confidence in President Moon's policy and also where it's headed. President Moon has 2 years left in his presidency, and there's many policies that he still likes to continue and implement. And if he doesn't have the support from the National Assembly, this could impact how President Moon's policy will move forward.
And right now, the parliament is actually hung, right? There's no actual party with a majority of seats in parliament. So really, if President Moon is able to secure a majority in parliament, he's actually going to be able to really ramp up in implementing the policies that he really wants. Now, I also heard that this election is going to be a little different from previous elections that we've had in South Korea. Could you tell us a little more about the composition of the new electorate?
So for the first time ever, the voting age was lowered from 19 to 18. And this means that over 500,000 new constituents will be coming out to polling booths in April. It's unclear how this will impact the election, whether they will support more for conservative parties or progressive parties, but there's no doubt that having this younger generation of voters will impact how the candidates approach their policies and what platform they use to engage with the voters. There are also some major issues that will be important for this coming election. As Kyle mentioned, how the government handles the coronavirus and other public health and safety issues will be one of the major factors for the voters to decide on which party they want to vote for.
Now, there's a lot of immediate issues that the South Korean government is facing. As you mentioned, coronavirus, the security challenges from North Korea, alliance with the United States. These are all immediate, urgent things that South Korea has to deal with and that the new parliament has to deal with. But of course, there is also overarching structural issues that South Korea is facing. In particular, South Korea faces a major demographic crisis that the government must engage immediately. Troy, could you give us a sense for how rapid the decline in fertility rate has been in South Korea?
It's been fairly significant. Last year, meaning 2018, you had the birth rate drop to below one for the first time. The final numbers for 2019 are not out yet, but in the third quarter of the year, you saw birth rates decline to 0.88. There's been a consistent decline throughout last year. The expectation is that in 2020, the South Korean population overall will begin to decline. So we're at a point to where birth rates are at historically low levels in comparison to other countries, and that there's a real crisis here because you're seeing a rapid shift in the population much quicker than in any other country. And so there's going to need to be a more sustained effort in terms of trying to find ways to deal with this. It's not going to change overnight. We've seen a few European countries like France and Sweden who've been able to take and boost birth rates slightly. But, you know, it's something that the government's going to, I think, have to spend more time and effort trying to address.
Now, of course, there's the crisis on the other end of the age spectrum. Just like we're not having enough children, we're also having a growing number of elderly in South Korea, but these elderly face a particular problem in South Korea that is quite unique, which is that they're facing a lot of relative poverty. South Korean elderly are more susceptible to earning 50% or less of the median household income than any other country in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is a particular crisis that South Korea is facing today. Now, the government has proposed giving more allowances for the elderly, more fiscal resources for the elderly, but it's not just an issue of money. The elderly in South Korea are facing not just a resource deficit, but also facing a deficit of community. We're seeing increased rates of mental health, a lot of elderly complaining about loneliness, which has exacerbated this mental health issue. And so this is going to require a more of a concerted public policy effort on the side of the South Korean government to tackle. But I think this is an issue that complements the fertility issue that Troy mentioned earlier.
There's actually a study from a couple years ago that suggests that a South Korean woman born in 2030 would have the longest lifespan of anyone in the world. And so South Korea is being hit on both ends of this demographic issue. Koreans living increasingly longer while there are fewer Koreans being born. And, you know, just to touch on a couple other things about this, you know, one, on the elderly side, one of the other challenges isn't just poverty, but there's a much higher elderly suicide rate in South Korea than in any other developed country in the world. So you have that challenge as well. And I think the other thing to keep in mind that I think makes this challenging is that when we think about societal change in South Korea has been perhaps faster than in any other country in the world too, given where it came from, the Korean War, rapid economic development, and all the social mores and standards that have changed. And there's still challenges. I mean, you know, we've seen the Me Too movement and the challenges women face. But if you look at where South Korean society started and where the elderly are today in society, it's a completely different world than they were born into and grew up in. And so I think that's part of the other challenge we face when you talk about things like lack of community, is that society has changed so much that Korea is really trying to grapple with how it deals not with just with these demographic challenges, but with all the societal changes as well.
And speaking of societal challenges and the creation of new communities, we have a new community being created in South Korea today online. In 2019, South Korean teens spent an average of 42 hours a month watching YouTube videos. And this is not just for the youth. It's also interesting that people in their 50s and above watch a significant amount of YouTube videos as well, with an average of 20 hours a month. So, Sang, what are these South Korean YouTube communities watching?
So music and entertainment-related content still remain as the most popular on YouTube. So this includes, you know, K-pop videos, music videos, dance videos. But we're increasingly seeing different content that's been created by different people. So for example, there are videos about fitness, home training, how to get jobs.
And do you feel that this is going to change how South Koreans consume information, news, and also how public policy is rolled out?
So because over 90% of the population owns smartphones, so that means that they can access these videos whenever, wherever they would like, instead of, you know, going home and watching TV. YouTube is increasingly becoming the place where people go for entertainment, web search, and also becoming a marketing center. You see nowadays, not only the private companies have YouTube channels, but even government agencies also have YouTube channels created to really promote their ideas and communicate with their audience. Recently, the National Board of Election has recruited Pengsu to really appeal to the younger voters who I mentioned earlier just became a new constituent. So they're utilizing YouTube stars' popularity into the policies that they would like to pursue because it's becoming so popular and appealing to a lot of people in public.
That's it for our episode today. Many thanks to Troy, Sang, and Kyle. And to you, listeners, for tuning in. If you are wondering what or who Pengsu is, which director Sang Kim was referring to at the very end of the interview, it's an anthropomorphic penguin character developed by South Korea's public education channel EBS for its YouTube channel. It debuted in April 2019 and saw explosive growth in popularity. In addition to its recent efforts to increase youth turnout in the upcoming legislative election, Pengsu was also employed by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to promote the ASEAN-South Korea Summit in Busan last year. A very interesting case study of how popular brands are used in South Korea. More on that another time. We'll be back next week. See you then!